So, we're starting a beginning a new series today, and it's got a weird name. And some of you, when I say it, you'll know exactly what it is and try to figure out why it has anything to do with sermon. And some of you never heard of it before, but it's called the Johari Window. Johari Window is this technique. It's something that was created back in 1955 by two guys. One's name was Joseph Luft, and one's name was Harry Ingham, and hence the name Johari. I would guess. I'm assuming, but Joe and Harry, and you say them together fast. Johari, Johari Window. Creative, right? Real scientific. The Joe and Harry Window is what I'm guessing. I may be wrong. If not, I like it better than any explanation you could give me. So the Joe and Harry Window, and it was created in 1955. To help people better understand their mental instability. Hence why we're preaching it to you at Awestruck over the next 4 weeks. Like, what better place, right, to discover and help with your mental instability. Not actually, it's a technique they created that's been adapted, but it's still used in different ways through corporate settings and self-help groups and things like that. What it does is help you understand yourself, and it helps others to understand you, and so it's a team building / self-awareness building type exercise. And what you do is you take a list of 56 adjectives. They're mostly positive. I mean, I guess some, if you didn't have the trait, you might not think it's positive, but you have 56 adjectives, and you're asked to take your out of 56 to choose between 5 or 6 adjectives that describe yourself, and you write them down. And then you go and find, if you're in a corporate setting, it'd be the people you work with, your bosses or whatever, or in a social setting, friends, family members, and you ask them to take the same 56 adjectives and ask them to pick out 5 or 6 adjectives out of the list that describe you, and then you compare the list. And when you compare the list, you come up and you put them into a 4-paneled grid. It looks kind of like this, the technical version. Maybe it'll pop up. It's just white, it's blank. And some of them are white. This one has the explanations on it, and you see known to self, not known to self across the top, known to others, not known to others down the bottom. You create this open spot, the blind spot, the hidden spot, and the unknown spot, right? I did this myself just this week, and actually yesterday I sent out an email and said, hey, here's 56 words that describe, that could possibly describe me, and I had I've never done this. I mean, I guess I did in college, but I probably wasn't there that semester and mentally. And so I'm sure they did it in college. I just, you know, was probably out riding my bike or whatever, was sleeping. Sorry, Mom. I didn't go to class a lot. And thanks for paying for my education. And I gave the list, and I asked my brother, because I tried to get people that knew me. My little brother, who's a couple years younger than me, and my wife. And that was really more of a test for her. Like, this is what I wrote. How many can you match? And then I asked some leadership in our church, Evan and Tyler and Pastor Mike, and asked the 5 of them to send back 5 words. It was interesting because I now have my own Johari window, things that are known to me and things that are known that they knew about me, things that lined up compared. Things that are that they sent back to me that I didn't add in my list, and some of them I know about myself. But to stay true to the exercise, I wrote them in the not known to self but known to others. And then there were some that were not known to others but known to me, and things that, you know, I wrote down. And so it was this interesting thing to learn about me and to have to write them down and see who agreed with me. Things like extroverted. Right? I mean, most of you are like, duh, right? That would have been the first one you would have sent to. Observant, that was a nice one. Giving, witty, and bold. And you may disagree with some of those. That's why I didn't ask you to participate, because you'd have been mean. My little brother actually emailed me back and said, can I do this anonymously? And there's some words I'd really like to use to describe you that aren't on the list. Can I add to the list? No, just stick with the list. And so it was interesting to get this back, this quadrant, this known to others, known to self quadrant of, okay, here's, you know, 5 things that others see in me and that I see in me, And they're there, and this is part of the experiment of the Johari window. The reason it's called a window is because I'll show you another picture. It's an artist illustration of the Johari window. You see, it actually looks like a window, right? Like an old four-pane window. It kind of has the view of the four different panes, and so that's why it's called the window. Another scientist, psychologist, uses it. He calls it the house, and he has a whole different picture, but still the same concept. What do you know about you that other people know about you? What do other people know about you that you don't know about yourself, maybe? What are the things that you know about you that, man, you'd hate to for anybody to find out, right? Most time, the things that other people don't know, it's not by accident, and we're going to talk about that in week three, so that'd be a good week for you to skip, just throw it and listen on the podcast privately and cry alone. And we're going to talk about that, wearing the mask and the facade. And then we're going to conclude this series with the things that only God knows about us. And today we're going to begin by opening up by talking about the arena. The thing that we do on stage, in essence, the shared life, the public life, the thing that I know about me and the things that you know about me. It's this thing that everybody knows. It's not my blind spot. It's not the things that others see but you don't. And it's not the hidden stuff, the facade. It's not the stuff that you don't even know. It's the stuff that I know that you know. You know it about me, I know it about me. There's things that I know about you that you know about you. And this is our shared public life, and this is where we're supposed to be. And I want to begin by saying thank you to Pastor Mike, who did the majority, 99.999% of the research for the sermon today. And so to be shared and to be public, to say that, you know, man, he wrote a great sermon and I get to preach it. And that's just brutal honesty. One thing we're not around here is we try not to be prideful, although one of the things I didn't know about me that others did, like all of them except for me, said that I'm proud, but they all clarified it with a, but not in a bad way, right? It was good. All of them said proud, but not proud in a bad way. And so one thing we're not is prideful, and so if you enjoy the sermon, you can tell Pastor Mike thank you afterwards for all of his work to get things ready. But we're going to talk about the arena, the public self, the shared life. And the whole purpose really of this Johari window is to grow our arena. I mean, that's the whole reasoning behind this deal, is to so that we would grow our shared life. Because I think it's sad how small most of our shared life is, isn't it? I mean, like the things that people know about us, the things that I know that you know, is such a small area usually. Usually in the Johari window, when you do it, the other quadrants get filled up, and the things that others know that you know is the smallest area. And the whole point of the exercise is then to grow the arena. It's to grow our shared life, because we all do really well sharing about certain things, our accomplishments, our favorite sports team, our kids, our work, what we love about our work, but really what we hate about our work, right? We have no problem sharing about those things. But when it really comes to intimate details, our arena, our shared life is kind of small. But if you look scripturally and you look at our life from creation, from the moment it all began to redemption, you've been designed to share life with other people. That's the design. The design was not that you go and live on a deserted island by yourself and try to figure this thing out alone. You were created to do life together and to share life with other people. And I think this, that if your shared life is just surface level, it's kids, job, house, accomplishments, cars. If it's just surface level, then I think we're destined to be surface level Christians. Because I think that we'll never grow closer to God than we're willing to grow close to each other. And most people would disagree with that. They don't like that statement. But we'll never grow closer to God than we'll actually grow or willing to grow as close to people around us. Our willingness to have relationships with people around us is going to determine our level and our maturity and our relationship with God. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 18, it says, "Then the Lord God said, 'It is not good for man to be alone.'" Pardon me, that's my gum. It says, "It's not good for man to be alone. I'll make a helper who is just right for him." And what we see is that creation was completed and it's good. God made all things. He rested. He said, it is good. He made man and he said, it's good. Adam and God were walking in this perfect relationship with him. There's no sin. There's no separation. There's no temptation. There's no nothing. It's Adam and it's God. And God has looked and you see, he's made it and said, it is good. And after all this time where he's walking in this perfect harmonious relationship with God is then when he makes this statement that we see in Genesis chapter 2, verse 18. See, because you think this is I wish I could just go back. If it'd just be me and God, no temptation, no. If I could just be in there, man, I'd have no problem failing, right? I'd love God with all my heart and all my soul if there wasn't all this stuff around me. And yet it was in this moment, this perfect little test tube where it's just Adam and just God that God makes the statement, this is not good. He says, it's just us and this is not good. And he says, it's not good for man to be alone. I'll make a helper who'll be just right for him. It was in the relationship that he spoke these words. Not a, man, Adam's really struggling over there. I better send him somebody to help him. It was perfect. There was nothing to mess it up. And God said, this is not good. See, God himself understood this need that within every human is a desire and a need to have somebody alongside them to help them attempt to follow God. God himself understood the need. And what so if God then took a rib out of Adam, right? I mean, he it was such a big thing. He didn't just make it. He didn't just clump up dirt and he didn't just speak it. He actually ripped a rib out of Adam's side, right? He ripped it. It was this brutal thing. I'm sure that the next day there was a mark. We don't really read about that. But he caused him to fall asleep and he removed something from Adam. And out of that, he formed Eve. And yet there's Christians who would say, I don't really need fellowship. My faith in God is personal. It's just me and God. I don't really need anybody else. I don't really need the church, and I don't really need people. I just need God. Who are we then to think that if God took it so seriously that he removed something from Adam to create to him a helper that would make it good again? Then who are we to think that we have the right to ignore and to take ourselves away from this gift that God provides of community and of fellowship? And Pastor Mike said it before, and I got a lot. I wasn't here that Sunday, but I love the comments that I got back. Pastor Mike said there's no such thing as personal faith. And boy, some of y'all did not like that at all. But I do think maybe there is personal faith, and that 100% personal faith, just you and God, is called sin. That you would live your life just you and God. Not let anybody else in. Now hear me, you come to God personally. That's not what we're saying. Your grandma can't take you to God, and your friends being saved doesn't make you saved. But to have a personal faith that's 100% you and God, all I need is God, I don't need anybody else around me, that's called living in sin. Because God created us and then he gave us this gift. He gave us this gift of church, which is the gathering of the believers, the called out, the saints, a community of faith where there's encouragement and accountability and all those things. He then gave us this gift, and that is to do life together. He said of Adam, it's just me and him. This is not good. He needs somebody else. And to about you and for you, he says, it can't just be you and God. You need other people in your life, and this is the shared, this is the arena, this is the first part of the Johari window that says, I know me and you know me, and we're living our life together. His church was intended to be more than our social hour. Y'all know that, but isn't it kind of fun to come and just talk? And how easy is it for church to become our social hour? Our Christian community was meant to be more than just going to church for an hour, for a little bit. We were created to accept a gift of community. We were created to accept. What a beautiful gift God gave us. Isn't that awesome? I mean, he could have just made us all a bunch of individuals, kept making different worlds for us to live in, and we'd be like in little, aquariums all by ourselves, like pets of God, and I'd be alone, and you'd be alone, and you'd be alone. But yet he created us, and he put us all together for a reason. This was the gift that he gave us, the gift of community, the gift of shared life. And actually, we see it in God, we see it in creation, but we also see it in the life of Jesus and the way that he lived his life. But then at the very end of the life of Jesus, he begins revealing his passion to us. In John chapter 17, verse 20 through 23, this is one of the last acts of Jesus in front of his disciples. One of the last things he does before he's arrested and then eventually crucified and risen again. All those things. This is one of his last things, and he's praying in front of his disciples for his disciples. And in John chapter 17, starting at verse 20, says, "I am praying not only for these disciples, but also for all who will ever believe in me through their message." Look at verse 21. "I pray that they will all be one, just as you and I are one, as you are in me, Father, I am in you, and may they be in us, so that the Lord will believe you sent me. I have given them the glory you gave me, so they may be as one as we are one. I am in them and you are in me, and may they experience such perfect unity that the world will know that you sent me and that you love me as much as you love me." You love them as much as you love me. I mean, this is one of his last acts. And Jesus exposes to us one of the things that's closest to his heart. His concern is this, is that the relationship of his followers will be one. He is concerned about how closely related his followers will be. And his prayer then is this, is that we would not live alone and we'd not try to do this thing by ourselves or have this only a personal faith that's between me and God. No, you and God saved you. You came to Christ and we live out our faith in a public forum. We live it out in community. We live it out with other people, with one another. And you say, then why is this so important, Josh? Because some of you, this is old hat, and I can see it, and you're like, okay, I got it. And some of you, it's messed you up. I know with my wife, when I shared the personal faith thing, she's like, well, I don't know about that. And so wherever you sit, the question I believe that resides, that we need to answer so that you can walk away. I had somebody last week, they told me, they said, you know, I don't always fully understand what you're trying to say, but I always understand how I'm supposed to apply it. And I think that's a compliment. I think it was. And so I think the most important thing then we have to answer is this, is why? Why is this even important? Why would we even talk about this? What are the benefits? What's the downside? What's the upside? Why is it important to do life together? Why is it important? Why should we be doing this? Why? I think three things. Number one is this, is that if you don't, you're cheating yourself. When you choose to not live your life in a faith-based community, and hear me, this is not saying come to church every Sunday, because it's summer. Nobody comes to church during the summer. We see it like, yeah, y'all love it, man. You got your own row. You got your own. We're not having to put out chairs. It's summertime. This is not come to church every Sunday. This is in the Sunday morning, outside of the Sunday morning. Who are you living your life? Who's your community of faith that you're living it with? And if you don't have anybody, if the answer is nobody, then you're actually cheating yourself. You can only grow so much with personal discipline, right? Have any of you ever decided you're going to lose weight but don't tell anybody about it? You're going to surprise them later? And the only surprise is that you couldn't stick with the diet because there was nobody there telling you any different, right? Like, yeah, I'm just not going to eat cheeseburgers anymore till tomorrow when I'm hungry and on the road and busy. Because there was nobody for me to call and go, I'm about to eat a cheeseburger. Tell me I'm a bad, bad boy. Make me stop. Take it away from me. Remove all the chocolate and everything, the cookies, and quit making cakes. And because we got it, personal discipline only takes us so far. If you can't lose weight without the help of a trainer or a family member encouraging you, what makes you think you're going to stay close to God and grow in God? This is one of the reasons God said of Adam, this is not good. He needs someone else. My son Micah is a good baseball player. He really is. And I brag about him a lot. But I'll tell you, he's a good baseball player. Maybe one of the best on his team, honestly. In this last season, he was one of the oldest. He's moving up. Probably one of the best on his team. He would have fit into the, if you were to categorize them, but we're not allowed to as coaches, even though we do, but you can't say it out loud, I guess. And he was definitely one of the better ones on the team. You wanted him at bat. He was one of the ones you wanted them to hit him the ball because he could catch and he can throw. You wanted him to be hitting the baseball when the moment was crucial and we needed to score runs with runners on base. You wanted him. He was one of the better kids on his team. By far the best little boy that's ever played baseball in my backyard, by far. I mean, I'm telling you, when he gets out in the backyard and I'm tossing him ball, he catches better, hits better, throws better. He does everything better than any other little boy that's ever played baseball in my backyard. Alone, he is unstoppable because he's the only one. And comparatively to some of the other kids on his team, it's a rec league, and some of those kids have never even played baseball before. He's better than them. Because he started when he was three. And in his mind, what I started seeing in him towards the end of the season was a sense of contentment. He was just content to be better than some of the kids on his team. He was content that he could go out and hit it off his tee or he could catch it in the yard. And he was content to be. Well, something changed in him about 3 weeks ago. We got invited to play on a little summer team where we're going to play some tournaments. And he is now playing on a team where he's not the best. Everybody on that team is as good as or better than him. And that first practice, man, it shook him up. Because he went from being the man to being just another teammate. But in 3 weeks, something's changed in him. I see more desire to be better. A kid who's always had an incredible arm and just a laziness with his accuracy, he don't miss throws anymore. When he stands in the batter's box, it's not a, if I get a hit, it'll be okay. It's a, I better hit the baseball. I better catch this when it comes to me. Because there's this sense around him that he's no longer the man. He's just a player. Everybody's as good as or better than him. And he better step his game up or else he's going to be sitting himself on the bench. Are you with me? There was something that clicked in him when he got around a sense of accountability. He got around a new sense of encouragement. The coaches are no longer clapping because you caught it. Good job, Micah. It's a, you could have caught that better. Two hands. Make a better throw. Good throw. Make a better throw next time. Good catch. Make a better catch next time. Good stop. Where are you going to go with the ball after? He got around a new sense of encouragement. And it's not mean coaching. It's just a different level of expectation. Can I tell you, in your personal faith, when you're at home watching Joyce Myers or whoever you're watching on TV, when that's just you and you're sitting with your Bible at home and your TV at home, there's a different level of expectation. There's a different level of encouragement. There's a different level of accountability when it's just you and God sitting at your house than there is when you step into this gathering of believers. Because when you surround yourself with other people, then all of a sudden something clicks in me. There's people who are spurring me on to grow more and people who are encouraging me to do the better things. There's people who are holding me accountable to the things that are holding me back. And when you choose to not live your life openly in fellowship with a community of believers in church, and what you've done is you've cheated yourself. Well, the second thing leading into that is I think you cheat your church. There's something you bring to us or to a community of believers that you're leaving out. Romans chapter 12, verse 4. Romans chapter 12, verse 4 through 8, it says, just as our bodies have many parts and each part is a special function, so it is with Christ's body. We're many parts of one body. We all belong to each other. In His grace, God has given us different gifts for doing certain things well. So if God has given you the ability to prophesy, then speak out with as much faith as God has given you. If your gift is serving, serve well. If your gift is teaching, teach well. If your gift is to encourage, be encouraging. If your gift is giving, then give generously. If God has given you the gift of leadership ability, take responsibility seriously. And if you have the gift of showing kindness to others, do it gladly. Every one of us brings something, and if you leave your part out of the community, then you're actually cheating the church. You're cheating the gathering. Ephesians 4:16 says, He makes the whole body fit together perfectly as each part does its own special work. It helps the other parts grow. Do you hear that? When you do your part, everybody grows. When they do their part, you grow. When you do your part, everybody grows. It says, when it helps the other parts grow so that the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. 1 Peter 4:10 says that God has given each of you a gift from His great variety of spiritual gifts. Use them well to serve one another. See, you can't fall in love with Jesus and choose to not fall in love with His church. You can't do that. You can't separate the two. You can't say, I love God, but not His church. It's all or nothing. It's a package deal. You can't say to me, Josh, I love you. Man, I love you with all my heart. I think you're funny. I think you're cool. I want to hang out with you. But whatever you do, do not bring your wife and those kids. More often than not, it happens to Shannon that way. I love you, Shannon. I love your kids. Please leave Josh at home. Please leave Josh at home. See, we're a package deal. If you get me, then you get Shannon and you get the kids. Wouldn't you be offended, Corey, if somebody's like, dude, you're awesome. You play basketball. Let's be friends. But don't bring Lauren and them children. A child and a half. Right? Right? That'd be offensive, right? Christy, you probably get it all the time, and it's probably true with Jonathan. But for, like, on a real marriage, like an average marriage, you get one, then you get the other, right? Like, you don't. Yeah, how offensive would that be? And yet, what has Jesus called us? We're the bride of Christ. The church is the bride of Christ. There's nothing on earth that God loves more than the church. We're His bride. And you can't say that I love God and I'm going to love Him with all my heart, but not His church. Not His church. And so you cheat yourself, number one. Number two, you cheat the church. But I think maybe the last point sums this up is that you end up cheating the world. See, there's a world on the outside who's looking in. And what they want to know is, do they really believe what they're selling over there? I mean, we used to always say, you know, I'm not going to say what we always used to say. I was going to say, if you won't smoke it, don't sell it. But that's not appropriate for the podcast or sermon and mama here. But you cheat the world. Like, if you don't believe in what we're selling, and there's a world of value. I did say it, didn't I? I was thinking out loud. There's a world on the outside that's watching. They're judging. They're evaluating. They're questioning. Is what they really, and what they're claiming over there, is that really going to work? And they're watching our relationships. And so if we choose to not live in relationship and in community with others, we're actually not only cheating ourselves and cheating the church, but we're actually cheating the world. Because Jesus is really found to others in our relationship with other people. People on the outside see Jesus in our relationship with other people. John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35 says, "So now I'm giving you a new commandment, love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other." Verse 35 says, "Your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples." Remember Jesus' prayer back in John chapter 17? In John chapter 17, find it with me. In verse 21, it says, "I pray that they will all be one, just as you and I are one, as the Father, as you are the Father, and you are in me, and Father, I am in you, and may they be in us, so that the world will believe that you sent me." So that the world will believe that you sent me. Jesus said that it's important for His followers to have a relationship with each other, to be close with each other. And in that prayer, He said, and it's important that this happens. Why? So that the world will believe in what we're selling and what we're promoting. Francis Schaeffer once said, "Our relationship with each other is the creation of the is the criterion the world uses to judge whether our message is truthful." Christian community is the final apologetic. You see, we're designed from the beginning and all the way through our life to share life with each other. We share our celebrations. We share our struggles. We share our tragedies. We share our passions. We share our successes. And we do life together. It gets messy, doesn't it? A couple weeks ago, we were talking about our weakness and our strength, and I was so tired. I just confessed all my weaknesses. And that gets messy, doesn't it? I mean, it was. You can almost sense the uncomfortable spirit in the room. Like, that's not what the pastor is supposed to do. And why didn't he just say happy things and pat us on the back and send us away? Because all of a sudden it got real. And when we get real and we start sharing and we start exposing, the mess comes with it. I mean, there's mess that comes with it. There's things that I don't want people to see. And if you just pop into my house, we don't like to clean. We're too busy having fun at my house. Anybody else say amen? I mean, we're too busy having fun to clean up. And you're like, if you ever think, I'm just going to swing by Josh and Shannon's and see how they're doing, we won't let you in the house because it ain't clean. Because what's behind the door is not, you're not welcome there. that's our stuff. And it's like we keep our blinds closed and stuff. I've learned that even when I do try to clean up, it takes about 10 seconds for my kids to pull all that mess back out. I'm like, why? I give up. And why make up a bed? You're getting back in it. Come on, that's right. Now I'm preaching, ain't I? And all the wives just went, we are never coming back here. And all the men went, yeah, that's right. But see, there's something that's behind my door that's not meant for you to see. There's people I'm comfortable with, my wife, my kids. But man, if you don't call first, you ain't making it past the porch. Because we ain't swept and stuff. Laundry might still be piled up. And I'll tell you, it's laundry day last Wednesday. You know, like, we just, why fold it? You're about to go, you just grab it off the chair, right? And we don't live in a sloppy house. But it ain't always company clean. Y'all with me? And then there's a big difference in company clean and, mom and daddy are spending the night to keep the kids clean. Right? I just woke somebody over here up, right? Because mom and daddy spending the night clean means they're going to hang their stuff in your closet. And the closet's where we make company clean happen, right? Like, oh, throw it in the closet. See, there's always something. There's different levels and different variations of what you can and can't see. And when I start talking about the emotional and the spiritual and the mental stuff, you're like, I don't really understand. But you see it, right? Because we all have that thing in our house. There's that one room, that one closet that we chunk everything into when company comes over. But then there's something even more that's even kind of deeper when somebody's spending the night and they need that closet. Now we got to clean out that closet and we got to get everything really out in the open and expose it. And this is the life that we're talking about, the arena, the shared life, the I know me and you know me. And it gets messy when you start throwing that junk out in the middle of the floor. It gets messy when you start letting people in before you've had a chance to smooth it over and cover it up. You just let people in, and it gets messy. And the way that we do life together, really, when we really start doing life together, is when we learn to expect the mess, but also we learn to accept the mess. And you start inviting people in, maybe to even help you clean it up. Maybe to help you get rid of. Maybe to help you replace. Because when God teaches us about sharing life together, He said, love one another. He said, be devoted to one another. Honor one another. Rejoice with one another. Serve one another. Carry one another's burdens. Forgive one another. Encourage one another. Offer hospitality to one another. Confess our sins to one another. He said, pray for one another. And then He said, celebrate God with one another. And a lot of times we show up and we like celebrating God. That's what we call this hour of church on Sunday. But you see, nowhere in the Bible does it say that do all these things, unless, of course, you're not a people person. And if that's the case, don't worry about it. Somebody else will pick up the slack. He actually commanded all of us. He said to all of us that we should do these things for one another. We should be in unity with one another. And these are commandments. And we've been created to live our life in relationship and in community with God. When Adam was alone, God put him to sleep. And He removed. It just seems like such a... We read it, and it may not have been, but it's hard for me to think that having a rib removed. I just had a little bitty surgery on my shoulder last year, and it still like jacked me up. It's hard to think that He didn't at some point bend over or something, go, oh, something's different there. I mean, Adam had this rib. It seems like such a violent thing that he gave up something of himself. From his side, God removed a rib, and He created Eve, and He made things good. Out of one man, God made community. But Adam had to give something up to make that happen. That had to happen. And what we see there is we see this foreshadowing of what happened to Jesus on the cross in John chapter 19 as we finish up. In John chapter 19, verse 34, it says, one of the soldiers, Jesus has died, He's hung, He's died. It says, one of the soldiers, however, pierced His side with a spear, and immediately blood and water flowed out. And Jesus dies on the cross, and from His side, they pierced the side. And from the side that's pierced, we're reminded of Adam. We're reminded of the pain that Adam went through. We're reminded of loss. We're reminded of sacrifice. We're reminded in this moment of what we saw in Adam, and then we see in Jesus is then what is expected of us. That community is formed from individual sacrifice. And in order to live in community, it takes an individual, me and you, individually willing to give up something that we call life. My wants and my desires and my hopes and my private issues and my emotional issues and my scars that I don't want to get rid of and I don't want to expose. In order for community to be formed, it requires personal and individual sacrifice from the people that are coming in. And isn't it sad how small our public arena is because we're so scared to let people out? We're going to talk about the hidden, maybe the things that other people see, but you don't, next week. Pastor Mike will be preaching next week. I'm looking forward to just sitting and hanging out with you guys. But this is the thing that not so much that we're trying to hide, it's just the thing we've chosen not to expose. It's that thing that should be known, and if you just spent more time with people, they'd know it. These aren't the things you're trying to hide. They're the things that are kind of obvious. But you've chosen to abandon community. You've chosen to move away. And so I guess the question then is, what will you have to give up to live in deep, committed Christian community? To be part of a community of faith that you've been created to live in, what would you have to give up? What would that require? What would that take of you? Because that's how we've been created. That's how we've been born. But I'll tell you this as a last statement and to encourage you. Everything that I've always had to give up, the thing that I've always been the most afraid of letting go of, that thing that I thought identified me as me, everything you've ever had to give up in order to live in community, the things that seem so hard to let go of, it's always replaced with the joy and the encouragement by the surrounding of a community. Always. It's always replaced. And so we've been created to live in community. We've never been created to do this alone. Who is your community? Who are your people? I think it's almost unfair. You'd say, oh, my wife and family or my spouse and family. Outside of your family, who's that person? Who are those people? If you say awestruck, then what part of how much are you really sharing? How much are you really giving? What does it cost you to be part of a church? And you see, a lot of we have this mindset that be part of a church means they have the music I like, the preaching I like, and the children's ministry I like, and so that's where I go for now until that pastor says something else dumb from his college days and I'm never going back there again, and I'll go find me another church, and then that church will have the music I like and the preaching I like and the children's ministry. But really, to be part of church the way that the Bible described it, it cost them something. It was a giving up of me so that I can be part of we, so we can all be together. And so what should it cost you? What has it cost you? Let's pray.